Last year, for Martin Luther King's holiday, I gave a talk that was more kind of thematic about Martin Luther King. And in some ways, I wish I would do that again this year, today. It's my favorite American holiday. And I feel that the values that Martin Luther King based his life on are very much aligned or with the Buddhist values, and make some sense for Buddhists to celebrate him and talk about him. But it's not what I not the talk that I have today. And what I'd like to do is to try to give a series of talks starting tonight and then maybe for another night or two, I don't know, on the Buddhist topic of anatta, which is the subject of, which is usually translated as not self, sometimes as no self. And it's a theme which in some ways is very important for Buddhists. And it's something which is confuses a lot of people and infuriates others. You know, how could this, you know, this no self teaching, you know, how, what's that about? And of course there's a self. And, you know, when I have a itch, I don't scratch my neighbor's cheek. You know, I'm the one who has the itch. I'm the one who scratches. So I thought it's a big topic, and it's I think it's a very interesting one for practitioners. And today's talk is a little bit of an introduction to the a little bit of background for to prepare for that. And one of the things I want to say is that if you read the original suttas, discourses of the Buddha, where this teaching of not self appears, you find a lot of different teachings. It's a big, big collection of teachings, and you find a wide range of teachings there. But one of the themes that threads through these discourses of the Buddha is the idea that a person who becomes a mature practitioner, a person who develops the path far, attains a degree of mastery over his or her mind. And the idea of mastery is a very strong one. And you find in the tradition and in those ancient discourses that someone who has mastered their mind, who's tamed their mind, has learned how to work with their mind, you find a lot of languages, a lot of expressions, descriptions of strength or power, or powerful words to describe that person. So like the word arhat, which is the traditional word for an enlightened person. After the Buddha, everybody who's enlightened after the Buddha, fully enlightened, is called an arhat. And an arhat means a worthy one, someone who's worthy. And in a very couple of places in the suttas, an arhat, or the Buddha also, is called a maha-atta, a great self. It's kind of the same title as Mahatma Gandhi, same idea. And sometimes they're called, there's a whole, you know, last chapter of the Dhammapada, where mature practitioners are called Brahmins. Brahmins are kind of the priestly caste, the upper caste in ancient India and still in India, I guess. And, you know, it's kind of someone who's proud, dignified. And someone who's matured in the practice is sometimes called a Brahmin. Sometimes you find languages of royalty associated with the maturing of practice, that the person who is going to engage in the practice is like a king or a queen, a royal person, who's going to go in and into the jungle, for example, and find their way in an ancient path that's mostly overgrown, and clear that path, reclear that path, and reclaim an overgrown kingdom, which is deep in the jungle. So the practitioner there is likened to, you know, king or queen, royalty. And some of the qualities that are being developed in the practice are also likened to that of being a king with his ministers. Occasionally you find languages of being a warrior language, associated with the maturing of this path. So what's being described here is a mature person in the path, is someone who develops a degree of, I would say, strong degree of strength, personal power, personal mastery and ability. They're recognized as such, and they're celebrated as such. When someone becomes enlightened, it's said that they can give the lion's roar. And I once stood in front of the cage in the San Francisco Zoo. I was probably 4 feet away, and just me and the lion, and my son. I was holding my little son. He was maybe 3 years old, 2 years old. And there's the bars between us, luckily, but there was no window, just the bars, right? And this big lion roared at us, and it was like a primordial experience. I was just. I left. I mean, that really made a big impression on me. So make a lion's roar. You know, a lion's roar is when someone declares that they're enlightened. So again, a great sense of strength. So that's a little bit kind of in the background of these kinds of teachings. I don't know how Western Buddhist teachings come across. I know in some traditions, like in certain Tibetan traditions, like Shambhala tradition, they also have the images of warrior and mastery very much kind of built into that. I think that's particular Buddhist tradition. But in the Western Vipassana tradition that I teach in, it's not that often that we use that kind of language of mastery and developing personal power and becoming a warrior, becoming like a king or queen, and become a great worthy person or something. I don't think that so often. It's more likely you'll hear languages like practicing self-acceptance. You know, there's a book that popularizes this practice called Radical Acceptance. It's a great book, which we talk about the words acceptance, sometimes the word allowing, having an allowing awareness, accepting awareness. There's a kind of feeling of kind of being self-effacing, this not self-teaching is kind of like, well, you have to kind of, you know, not have so much ego, maybe give up your ego and be soft, be kind, be gentle. You know, you put together all these kinds of languages that some of us, like me, kind of use sometimes. Acceptance and allowing and kind and nonviolent and all these things. And you kind of start getting a different kind of feeling tone to the kind of person, where the path is taking you, than you do from these suttas, where the feeling tone is all the other kinds of words, like power and strength and royalty and Brahman and, you know, all these kinds of things. You following me? So, when the Buddha was teaching this teaching of, for now I'll call not self, it was also going together with this language of personal mastery, of personal strength. You know, they didn't use the word personal, but strength and power and, you know, real something. So, it probably, people didn't, you know, weren't so threatened by this idea of not self, in the same way that maybe some people here in the West were. Well, if there's no self, I'm supposed to give up myself, then, you know, I'm just going to be this blob, you know. I'm going to be pushed over. People are going to, you know, push me over easily. I won't be able to take care of myself or defend myself. And, you know, but if you get the sense of some mastery and power, you know, you can take care of yourself pretty well. Last Thursday, I went to St. Quentin and met with a meditation group there, the prisoners. And as part of the meeting, they talked about their practice. And one of the common descriptions of the practice that they gave us was they practiced a lot of letting go. They learned through the practice, the Buddhist practice, to let go. But what struck me was they talked about letting go, but what I picked up coming through them was a very strong sense of strength, and a sense of strength and dignity that they seemed to have in the letting go. They're asked in prison to let go of a lot of things, and if you don't let go, the consequences are really big for your well-being, for your sometimes your health. And so they've learned how to let go, and in that learning let go in very challenging situations, they'd also become stronger people. So letting go wasn't just something where you kind of diminish yourself. They weren't diminished by it, but letting go can also be something where you're enhanced by the letting go. You become stronger. So that's what I picked up when they talked about letting go, that they actually became stronger in the process of learning how to let go. So So I offer that as a background as we prepare to talk about this teaching of not-self. Now, the next thing in preparation for teaching about not-self is to talk about meditation a little bit. And meditation is the meditative understanding or meditative insight is the prerequisite for really understanding this teaching of not-self. I go so far as to say that the teaching of not-self is not meant to be a philosophy. It's not meant to be a point of view that you then adapt and say, oh yes, now I can apply that to everything. This is not-self, and this is not-self, and there's no self here. And some people do that. They kind of go around, they kind of have some kind of intellectual understanding of not-self, and they go around and they be a not-self person, you know. You know, and it just, you know, it's irritating sometimes. You know, there's no one there. Like, you know, you go out for dinner and they say, well, what would you like to have for dinner? Oh, you know, I'm not really here, so I don't really I don't really have an opinion. And that's kind of irritating because, you know, you don't want to choose for them. So sometimes the intellectual adaptation of this not-self teaching, which some people do, goes against the grain of what this whole enterprise is about. And what I like to suggest is that the not-self teaching is meant to be insights or understandings that arise out of meditative experience. So it's not supposed to be something you have to kind of study and get a dissertation on not-self so you understand it. But rather, it's something you're supposed to meditate well. And in the meditation, the not-self becomes clear what it's all about. So probably you don't say anything anymore. It's complete now, right? Until you have, but I will still try to talk about it the next few times. So then to talk about meditation. Little bit. It might be useful to think of the mind as an orchestra, and you're the conductor. So when you first sit down to meditate, your orchestra is out of control, out of tune. And not only that, but they have different, each player has a different score, different music they're playing, and they're going in all kinds of different directions. Because you can feel how fragmented the mind is when you sit down, sometimes sit down to meditate. You sit down with very strong intention, for example, to be present, to follow the breath. And even though you have all this intention, this great wish and motivation, the compulsions of the mind are stronger than your intentions. And so there's a kind of a fracturing or fragmentation or different agendas going. They're playing different music. You have this one idea that the advertisement for the show said, you know, Bach, you know, and you sit down to listen to Bach and you get, I forget his first name. I'm thinking of Zappa. What was his name? Yeah. And, you know, it's not what you had in mind, not what you paid your money for. And sometimes you don't realize that you're playing the wrong piece until someone rings the bell. And they go, oh, wait a minute, that's not what I came to do. But sometimes it's worse, right? Because not just one impulse, you know, one compulsion, but several different pieces of music come into play. And maybe they're playing, you know, different tracks at the same time, but not the track you want. And every once in a while you remember, oh, that, I'm on that track. I'm on the breath track. So you go back there. So that's one thing that can happen. You know, some musicians are playing these different tracks of music. And then there are, in the mind or in the body, the being, there is the kind of the track your body's on. What's going on with your body? Sometimes your body's not in harmony with what you want to do, with developing concentration on the breath. So perhaps, you know, your body can be wildly off. You know, maybe your body is really tense or contracted in some way. And so it takes a while for the body to get relaxed enough and soft enough so the body is in harmony with your intention to be focused on the breath. It's possible to override the body if you have enough willpower. But I think that really healthy meditation doesn't override the body. It actually learns to work with the body so the body comes into harmony with what we're trying to do here. But you sit down and you realize the body is doing its own things, like a different musician. It's like the drummers off in the pit. And they're kind of pounding away really loud, but who knows what music they're doing. And so that's going on. And then there's your emotional state. You sit down to meditate, and you're here to stay with the breath. But there's this overriding emotional state from something that happened early in the day. Someone made you really angry, or you got really angry with someone, and that anger has been simmering for hours. And even though it's not always forefront in your mind, the concerns of anger, when you sit, you know, it's still there. It's kind of like the mood that's always kind of there in the background, kind of interpenetrating or they're present. And so there's a strong mood that's there that has nothing to do with focusing on the breath. This mood is somehow casting an influence on what's going on. It's playing its own music. As opposed to the emotional state being in harmony with trying to focus on the breath. And there's a way in which the emotions can actually be very supportive of focusing on the breath, where they actually kind of help usher you into the breath in a very concentrated way. But you have all this momentum, perhaps. A person has all this momentum in their emotional being from this anger they had earlier today. And you can't just sit down to meditate and expect that momentum to just drop away suddenly. It's like this big charge is built up and it takes a while for the charge to dissipate. But then it might not just be one mood. It might be that, you know, you're really angry at what happened earlier. But then there's another track that's kind of going along next to it, another kind of emotional track, where you're anxious about tomorrow. And so you're kind of flipping back and forth between the anger earlier and this fear. It's a completely different thing, but something's going to happen tomorrow. And your mind kind of, it isn't just your thoughts are going there, but it also is influencing your emotional state, this fear. And that's always kind of there. And so there's a little bit of anger and a little bit of fear kind of here, kind of, you know, and they're playing their music. And then there's your thoughts. You know, your thoughts can go in all kinds of places, all kinds of directions. But more deeply than kind of a thought that's kind of deep is also your beliefs. And there might be all kinds of beliefs that are not in harmony with the music you want to play. And some beliefs, you know, for example, you might have beliefs that, oh, I can't do this. This is too difficult for me. I'm going to do it. I'll try it. And maybe it'll work today. But, you know, I'm not a really good meditator and, you know, it's not, you know, I'll give it the best shot I have, but it's not really going to work, you know. Or, you know, it'll just help a little bit. That these teachers, they say, you know, that, you know, it's always good to meditate. So I'm just going to do it out of a sense of duty, but I just trust those teachers. But really, you know, I can't really go very far. So that's a kind of belief that's there, and that's playing. That's a kind of a playing a certain kind of music, or there might be other beliefs that you know might believe. Oh, if I do this meditation, then I will just be, you know, really successful at my whatever, something in my life, and there's a belief that kind of there's all kinds of beliefs that that come into play. But they're in the background. And some of the beliefs are supportive of meditating, and some of the beliefs are wildly unsupportive, are not supportive at all. I read some interesting studies the last couple of days. See if I can... One of them was an interesting one where they put people's heads, you know, with the bodies on them, into this like little chamber, and then they were going to tell them that they were going to pass a current through their heads, and they were supposed to tell the experimenters like something like, I think, you know, when the intensity got strong enough, it started to hurt, so they could not do it any further. They wanted to measure, you know, what point. And so I guess they had some kind of light or meter that maybe in the little chamber, so you can see the intensity or something. And so the experimenters would push a button, and the different intensity levels would go up, and the subjects would report having feelings of charge going through their head, and then at some point they said that's strong enough, you know, they see the intensity. But in fact, there was no charge being passed through the chamber at all. Nothing was happening at all. She said the meter was going up and down, and somehow their mind was creating a charge. Another thing I read in the experiment, a book I'm reading about pain. And apparently there's some experiments they did where thinking about, I guess you have an injury someplace maybe, or thinking about that injury in a certain way, or the thinking about it can create the swelling to expand. You can swell more just out of thinking about it. So, you know, what you think has a big impact. You can create, you know, all kinds of stuff by what you imagine or what you think or whatever. So what we believe is really important. And so, you know, there's all the violin section and the flute section. You know, there are different beliefs. You know, they're playing different music. And their music maybe not very helpful. So here we have this orchestra that's playing all this different music, and a lot of it's out of tune anyway. And it's just a cacophony, and it's not, you know, doing anything beautiful. But you're the conductor. And I like this image of the conductor because, in a sense, the conductor is in charge. And we're asked, in some ways, to take charge of the cacophony of our minds, cacophony of our being. We have to be very careful about taking charge, at least from meditation's point of view, because there's some ways of taking charge which just adds the cacophony, just adds greater stress to the whole situation. But to some degree or other, we're learning to take charge. If it's nothing else, it's learning to let go, or learning to show up. Okay, I'm just going to show up in the present moment. That's my job. I'm going to show up. And in my image of one way the conductor deals with this chaotic orchestra is the conductor gets up there on the little stand and just stands there silently. And I've actually seen that where the orchestra is getting ready, they're tuning their instruments, and it's a little bit of cacophony, they're all tuning and doing their things. And then at some point the conductor gets up there and stands there. It just stands there, sometimes with a little stick, you know, just stands there. And then you see the orchestra just all gets quiet. Or I've heard of kindergarten teachers, when there's a cacophony of chaos in the kindergarten class, some teachers will just stand in the middle of the kindergarten class and start whispering something. And pretty soon, all the kids quiet down. If they yell and say, be quiet, that doesn't help, doesn't work. But there's something about the whispering that gets their attention. What's that? It must be something interesting. Or they all quiet down. So one way of dealing with the cacophony is just to show up and be quiet. And this is the kind of lends itself to the kind of language of showing up and be allowing, showing up and being accepting. Don't fight what's going on. Don't hold on to what's going on. Don't try to manipulate it. Just show up and be very present in this accepting manner. And that approach of showing up and being very accepting, I think one of the reasons why it's so popular here in the West is a lot of people who have been influenced by Western culture, by American culture, have been traumatized by that culture in some degree. And their sense of self, their sense of lack of self-worth, their self-esteem, their sense of confusion about themselves is so strong that the beginning point in order to get anywhere is practicing self-acceptance, self-compassion. Because if you don't, anything else just seems to be just going to add salt to that wound of I'm not good enough, or I'm terrible, or I'm a bad person, or something. And so we have to learn just to relax, you know, from all these beliefs we have about ourselves. So it's often a very a useful medicine for people here in the West. So sometimes, you know, the conductor just gets up there and just stands there, and that works really well. It's also very aligned with the idea of mindfulness, because mindfulness is just you show up and just pay attention to what's going on. That's all. Show up and pay attention. However, the ability to show up and pay attention, maybe it's the conductor, maybe it's the conductor, but there's still all these different facets of the human being, their mind, their emotional being, their physical being, and you could just kind of let them all slowly harmonize or quiet down with the conductor's presence. Or you can also engage them and use them and so they can actually start playing nice music together. After all, you don't want to just go to the to a concert and be content with the silence. The conductor comes up and stands there and everything quiets down. It's very quiet. But that's not what you came to hear. You came actually to hear the music, something beautiful being created. Some people, when they practice meditation, are in so much need of de-stressing that they focus primarily on the calming factors of meditation, getting calm, getting relaxed, getting quiet, which is very nice. But again, that's like, you know, it's nice, but it's less like the conductor getting the orchestra to be quiet so that it's ready to do something beautiful. So when you manage to get yourself somewhat calm in meditation, then you're ready for something else. And it's a pity not to actually make that beautiful thing happen. So sometimes the conductor has to actually go into the orchestra pit and actually work with some of these different players. So if your body is wildly out of harmony with your ability to sit and meditate and be quiet, maybe you actually need to do something with your body to get it prepared for meditation. maybe you need to exercise more, or eat better, or do something. Maybe it's not wildly out of harmony, but maybe it's just a little bit. And so you have to kind of spend some time being patient and working with the body so the body settles down. And there's a little bit of development of a yogic body when you sit and meditate. You develop, your body actually kind of changes if you spend a lot of time meditating. The shoulders begin relaxing, the chest kind of aligns itself better, the vertebrae, the muscles begin changing and shifting. Because, you know, it's kind of like a yogic posture you're finding your way into. And so it takes a while to do that. And sometimes it can take months or even years to really kind of let the body mold itself so it feels really comfortable and easy sitting in this way. So sometimes we have to work with that. And then there's our emotional body. Sometimes our emotional state is... is so wildly out of harmony with meditating that sometimes we have to do something about our emotional state, our emotional experience. And sometimes we do things like we go and have to do therapy, or we have to actually address particular issues in some kind of very powerful way. We take a class on depression or anger management or something. And so we have to go and do something about that. We can't expect, you know, that meditation is going to take care of everything. Sometimes it's not so wildly out of harmony. Sometimes just a little bit out of harmony. So we have to learn how to work with our emotional state. We have to learn to work with it in such a way that we can harmonize it or make it so the emotional state, emotional being, is something that supports the possibility of meditating. And, you know, the idea that our emotional state is something we can shift and make into a situation where it shifts it so it harmonizes with our purpose of meditating is maybe a little bit foreign to many, to a lot of people. But there are emotional states we want to cultivate because they're helpful. One of them is to be a little bit happy or joyful or grateful or appreciative or inspired. Part of the emotional state of being is a quality of confidence and faith. And so, you know, there can you actually cultivate confidence or cultivate inspiration or faith. And many times when people in traditional Buddhist countries, before someone meditates, they'll do some faith-inspiring activity, like they'll bow to an altar or do some chanting or make an offering of flowers to the Buddha or something. Do something. Or read a text. Do something that kind of gets that shift, begins shifting their emotional state, their emotional tone, so that they can, the emotional state is a little bit more in harmony with what they want to do. Or perhaps what it requires is actually to look at, spend some time looking at what's really going on emotionally. So you sit down with your anger, and you have to really enter into the world of anger for a little bit with mindfulness, so you really understand it and learn how to settle it in some deep way, rather than just letting it be there in the background, kind of influencing what's going on. Or perhaps it involves having some wisdom, some understanding about your emotional state, and then some wise understanding of how to be present for it, how to include it, so it doesn't kind of trip you over as you work. And then there's looking at our beliefs, really understanding what our beliefs, being sensitive that we have a lot of beliefs that might be coming into play that have a bearing on how the meditation unfolds. And so clarifying what those beliefs, I think, is very helpful. And perhaps cultivating beliefs, understandings, views that are actually supportive and helpful for the process of getting engaged in what we're doing. So you'll know when the orchestra is in tune and when the orchestra is beginning to play all the same music, because you'll start feeling something beautiful. You'll start feeling something really nice. You'll feel certainly calm, at ease. You'll feel some sense of joy or delight, sense of well-being welling up. And if you follow that and develop your meditation more and more, at some point, what gets developed is our what's in English, what's traditionally called powers, gets born or gets cultivated, and powers might also be called forces within us. So confidence becomes a force or a power. I like the word force here because it's actually something that kind of wells up, that's very strong, and that's helping you, channeling you in the direction you want to go. There's also a power called energy or effort. And there's at some point, you don't have to make some effort. Isn't something you have to make. Effort is not something, but effort is something which has a power of itself. Your effort, your ability to have energy, is not in disharmony with your meditation, but has come into harmony with your meditation, and it actually becomes a force that carries you. And it's no longer manual labor to meditate, but it's kind of like you're being kind of riding a wave of energy that's kind of carrying you along. Mindfulness becomes a force where you don't have to want to be mindful, you don't have to try to be mindful, but mindfulness is coursing through. Mindfulness is what's happening, and it's happening through you, with you. And another force that's talked about in the tradition is that of concentration. So concentration is not, again, something you have to kind of willfully make happen, but the mind is kind of, there's a force of concentration going on. You can feel yourself being carried by that force, engaged. And then another force that gets born is the force of discernment, of wisdom. Wisdom or discernment becomes a power that we have. And there's this tremendous clarity to really begin understanding what's going on, really seeing. The insight begins happening. And you get a sense, it's not even you doing it, but it's just this force of discernment, force of understanding, of wisdom, that seems to be operating and coming into play. So here with the language of power, as one of the things that gets born through meditation practice, you see again what I started to talk about the sense of personal mastery or power that seems to be in the traditional tradition. I think part of the strength of this analogy of being the conductor of an orchestra is that, is that even if you can't get the orchestra to obey, to listen to you, or to quiet down, your job is still to be the conductor who stands there in the middle of the pit, or stands there in the little stand, and is composed and calm and unreactive, not caught, not frazzled by what's going on in the orchestra pit. So your job is to find that place, the state of where you can be somehow at ease, independent of, non-reactive to all the different orchestras that are going on within you. To find that still point, to find that quiet place, rather than being caught and reactive to all the different things going on. And that's a huge training, huge undertaking to learn to do that. How to sit in the middle of your life as it is, with some composure and dignity, and not be tripped up by all the feelings, emotions, thoughts, memories, experiences in the world, projections into the future, you know, all the different things goes on. But how to learn to be a conductor in the middle of it. And as you learn to be that conductor, to have that stability, then you also begin to learn how to begin trying to harmonize all the different players that are involved in this ecosystem we call the human mind. As someone develops the path in Buddhism, a description of such a person is the person becomes luminous. They radiate like the moon in the night sky. Isn't that great? So, as a background for this teaching of not self, there is this task of taming the mind, or developing mastery over the mind, training the mind, much the same way you would train a ruly orchestra. And perhaps, you know, then you have to push the analogy a little bit further and realize that when you become the conductor, you don't get trained musicians. You get all these, you know, at least half the orchestra is made up of kids who've never picked up an instrument before in their life. So it takes a while to teach them how to play, you know, music and instruments. But it takes a while. You have to be patient, and patience is one of those members of the orchestra that has to become really strong. You have to develop really strong patience, so everything else can happen. So, those are my thoughts, and I hope that's interesting and useful. And for those of you who are going to come the next Monday or two, please keep this in mind when I start talking about not-self, so you don't interpret what I say to mean that you're supposed to become some kind of self-effacing, invisible blob as you become more and more a not-self person. Okay? Thank you.